A Venn diagram of baseball fan and movie buff shares such beloved films as Field of Dreams, The Natural, and Bull Durham in its intersection. But no baseball movie list is complete or able to be taken seriously without A League of Their Own. Released in 1992 by Columbia Pictures and directed by Penny Marshall, A League of Their Own tells the fictional story of two sisters who join the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League. The league was founded during the Second World War as a way to keep baseball alive while men were overseas. When the United States entered World War II, Chicago Cubs owner and shrewd businessman Philip Wrigley was nervous that baseball would suffer due to the number of players being drafted into the war. The draft was depleting his player base, and he needed a grand idea to save what he saw as a death sentence for the game. The answer was staring him right in the face. If men were the ones being drafted to fight, then why not use the one available resource at his disposal? And Wrigley did just that. In the movie, the real-life Philip Wrigley is made into the fictional Walter Harvey, a candy mogul played by Gary Marshall. At first, the women are shaken by the jeering, leering male fans. They were teased and belittled because girls can't play baseball. But as Penny Marshall breathes life into these characters, we see their determination and grit on screen. They are eager to be viewed as the legitimate players they are, and not simply an attraction in a short skirt. The All-American Girls Professional Baseball League kicked off in the spring of 1943 and began with four teams: the Racine Belles, the South Bend Blue Sox, Kenosha Comets, and the Rockford Peaches. Over the course of its 12-year run, 14 teams would come and go to keep the league alive and flourishing. Each team was comprised of 15 ballplayers, the coach, a business manager, and a chaperone for the women. It was presumed by ownership there would be greater interest by the public if prominent men's sports figures were involved in the upstart. Sometimes you have to prime the pump. The first managers selected were former Chicago Blackhawks player Johnny Gottschalk, former Cincinnati Red Bert Niehoff, former Cleveland Indian and St. Louis Brown Josh Billings, and Eddie Stumpf, former Milwaukee Brewers catcher. These men added a legitimacy in the eyes of the fan and helped to sell tickets early on. After searching the country for prospects, spring training was held at Wrigley Field on May 17, 1943, and along with a vigorous, exhausting tryout which demanded the highest proficiency in each phase of the game, running, hitting, etc., the women were expected to act as proper ladies off the field. Wrigley partnered with the famous Helena Rubinstein's Beauty Salon, which provided makeovers, and ran the evening charm school which all players were required to attend. They learned beauty routines, proper clothing, and of course, etiquette. After all, what good is a shortstop who can easily turn double plays unless she points her pinky while sipping tea? In the world of today's sports, each team wants as many superstars as possible that they can afford. A stacked lineup offers a leg up over the competition, but for the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League, parity and game balance were desired above all else. The last thing that league ownership wanted was one or two teams flattening their opponents through the season. That would not make for good ticket sales. Players were often traded mid-season to keep the play competitive and the teams as even as possible. Women in sports have always faced stigma and abuse. Hell, just being a woman has its own brand of stigma and abuse. Over and above all of that is the presumption that athletic women and women who play sports are often marked as lesbians. The act of a woman swinging a bat or fielding a fly ball shouldn't be political. But no matter your age, growing up, you have been blitzed with the idea that the ideal woman is demure, quiet, and for God's sake, she never sweats. After all, women don't sweat, they glow. For as long as women have played sports, lesbians have been there. When the ladies of St. Andrew's Golf Club started in 1843, lesbians were there. At the 1900 Olympic Games in Paris, where women competed for the first time in golf, sailing, tennis, croquet, and equestrian, lesbians were there. As mentioned earlier, League founder Philip Wrigley wanted feminine women on his teams, and feminine women representing the league. Aside from the charm school requirements and the rebuffed actions of smoking, drinking, or swearing in public, the players were made to wear those now iconic uniforms. In the time of the AAG PBL amateur and semi-professional softball, uniforms for women were comprised of satin shirts, long pants, or in some cases, even traditional baseball attire. The AAGPBL, however, demanded that players wear these impractical dresses. As May commented in A League of Their Own, there wasn't even room for cigarettes. Designed in part by Mrs. Wrigley, the uniform dresses were a belted tunic with a short, flared skirt worn with shorts. The dress buttoned up the front on the left side. Players were told to hem their skirts no shorter than 6 inches above the knee. While the first Barbie doll would not make her debut for another 15 years, Philip Wrigley treated these players exactly as his own personal dolls. Players Terry Donahue and Pat Henschel met and fell in love in 1947, when Donahue, then 22, was playing for the AAG PBL, and Henschel, 18, worked as a phone operator. And for more than six decades, they kept their love a secret. To their family and coworkers, they were just good friends who lived together. Donahue played softball in Moose Jaw, Canada, and was recruited to the AAG PBL's Peoria Red Wings in 1946. She played baseball until 1949. After she left the AAG PBL, she and Henschel moved to Chicago, where Donahue returned to playing softball. Had it not been for A League of Their Own, Donahue may have never come forward to discuss her private life. After all, why invite prying eyes to go digging into your affairs and opening yourself to possible ridicule? Unless you were ready to embrace your truth. The early 90s, while more open-minded and accepting than previous decades, was still not the safest of times for gays and lesbians who had yet to come out. In 2010, 84-year-old Donahue was invited to be the Grand Marshal of the St. Charles, Illinois St. Patrick's Day Parade. The article described Henschel as her cousin and roommate. Whether this was the choice of the writer, editor, or Donahue herself, we don't know, but the omission of her longtime partner is curious. But their story would soon come to life. Netflix, the distributor of fan-favorite shows like Stranger Things and Ozark, released A Secret Love in 2020. It's the telling of Terry Donahue and Pat Henschel, how they met, lived, and kept their surreptitious story. It can't be easy to keep your true self from your family, always afraid of your secret being known, always being afraid of someone finding out. The couple came out in the 80s to their families, but only after sacrificing decades of living their lives in painful quiet. The couple married in 2015, the year that marriage equality passed. It was Donahue's 90th birthday. After decades of being denied their fundamental right to marry, the couple, like many others, were finally able to legally bond their love. Josephine JoJo D'Angelo, born November 23, 1924, in Chicago, played baseball with the boys in her neighborhood at the neighborhood sandlot, hot summer days that extended into humid evenings. JoJo was like every other kid her age, wanting nothing more than to play outside with friends, no matter how unbearably hot it may have been. JoJo was a founding member of the AAG PBL. Both of her seasons, she wore the sapphire blue uniform of the South Bend Blue Sox. JoJo played 144 games with 499 at-bats, and with only three strikeouts in 358 at-bats, she led the league with the fewest strikeouts. She played in the first AAG PBL All-Star Game on July 1, 1943, which was also the first night game ever played at Wrigley Field. JoJo was part of many firsts in baseball. Her athleticism and spirit brought these joyous moments into her life. Unfortunately, for JoJo, that was not enough to keep her in the league. While staying in a posh hotel in early fall of 1944, Josephine made her way into the lobby and was noticed by a league executive. Believing the conversation would be either about the upcoming season or really anything else in the world rather than being about her haircut. Josephine was scolded for her dark bob and was told she had broken the cardinal rule of the league, which was play like a man, look like a lady. The executive referred to it as a butchy haircut and released her from the team and the league she had played so hard for the last two seasons. The sport that she gave her all to was now saying she was not good enough to play, not because of performance or professionalism, but because of the way she chose to style her hair. Rumor was she didn't want that haircut in the first place, but the beautician who worked with all the players thought the short do would frame her face in a better way. Did the beautician know that JoJo was a lesbian? Was it the job of the beautician to give certain players short haircuts so they stood out to executives? Admittedly, that is nothing more than conjecture, but we know the AAG PBL wanted nothing to do with gay players. The journey for gay and lesbian rights is less a marathon and more like a game of Uno. One moment you have a couple of cards and you're ready for victory, and the next you're either skipped or are forced to draw four cards, putting you further behind than you were a moment ago. Progress is not linear. In 1924, World War I veteran Harry Gerber founded the Society for Human Rights in Chicago. It was the first gay rights group in the United States, and its newsletter, Friendship and Freedom, was the first recorded gay rights publication in the country. On June 28, 1969, in the early morning hours, police raided the Stonewall Inn, a New York City gay bar. Instead of allowing the police to arrest and beat them down, patrons of the bar and their supporters took a stand. The event turned into a violent protest and led to a days-long series of riots. The Stonewall riots are considered the start of the LGBTQ civil rights movement in the United States. By 1973, homosexuality was no longer considered a mental illness. After years of studies and changing cultural outlooks, the American Psychiatric Association's board of directors removed homosexuality from the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. This was an important victory for gay rights, as they could no longer be labeled as crazy by the medical profession. But, as I mentioned, the timeline of gay rights in America was not simply forward progress. At times, it was not only stopped, but it was pushed back. On October 1st, 1993, Don't Ask, Don't Tell went into effect. This was President Bill Clinton's intention to end the U.S. military's longstanding ban on gay men and women in the armed forces. While his vision was supported by many Americans, it met a wall of opposition with congressional members in the Senate Armed Forces Service Committee and top military leaders. Clinton managed a compromise, instituting a measure where gay military personnel could remain in their posts if they did not openly declare their sexual orientation. The proverbial closet is now painted in olive drab and camouflage. By 2008, more than 12,000 officers had been discharged from the military for refusing to hide their homosexuality. 12,000 careers ruined and lives disrupted, all to champion bigotry and ignorance. Somehow, this feels familiar. Don't Ask, Don't Tell would remain the law for 16 years until a community organizer from Chicago took up residence in the White House. On June 19, 2009, Representative Jason Altmaier, a Democrat from the 4th District of Pennsylvania, sponsored H.R. 2965, the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, which allowed gay servicemen and women to openly serve. The bill was signed by President Barack Obama and became public law before the ink was even dry. On June 26, 2015, love wins. The Supreme Court officially declared same-sex marriage a constitutional right nationwide, which means all states must allow all Americans the right of marriage, regardless of their gender or sexual orientation. It's amazing that it took so long to codify such a basic right. Had the AAG PBL been a product of our time, of our generation, Terry Donahue and Pat Henschel would not need to hide their love for one another. They could live openly and happily, free from the fear of arrest and persecution. Had Josephine D'Angelo played ball today, she would not have had her dreams cut short because of her sexual orientation or her haircut. Who knows how great of a player she could have become, and what doors she might have opened. These are just two examples of the many women who were denied the right to play in the league, all because of who they loved. As said by Senator Edward Kennedy in a 1980 speech at Madison Square Garden, the work goes on, the cause endures, the hope still lives, and the dreams shall never die. Happy Pride Month, y'all. The Deadball Podcast was created by Tim Scott. This episode was written by Thad Scott and read by me, Nina Instead. Our technical support and audio editing comes from Chuck Walters. I appreciate you listening, and if you'd like to connect with like-minded baseball players, look for the Deadball Discussion Group on Facebook.